time for our monthly media segment, Signals and Noise. One thing we've noticed about running a monthly media segment in 2018 is that the topics do come fast and furious. We can try to lock up topics a few days in advance, but the fire hose of news frequently shuffles our deck right up to the last minute. That's okay. There's always plenty to talk about. And we do define media very broadly, taking in items about the media themselves and content delivered over a broad range of media, from virtual reality to books. Our regular guests are here, Andrew Gay and Precious Yamaguchi on the communications faculty at Southern Oregon University. Welcome, Precious.
Hi, good morning.
Welcome, Andrew.
Happy to be here.
And, you know, as I talk about the fire hose of information, I want to come back to where we were a month ago, because it was on the very afternoon of our last version of Signals and Noise that we began to get reporters using the word S-hole, and they spelled out the S part on
right.
the air. And so just, and it feels like a year ago already.
It does.
Yeah, so long ago.
When you brought that up in our emails about what we're going to talk about this week, I was like, wait, was that this year?
It was one of those deals where it's like you postmark the letter because you want something official. And so I emailed you guys that afternoon to say, can you believe it? We just had a Signals and Noise this morning, and now you've got newscasters on NPR saying the entire word that was purported to be said at the White House. I mean, if that alone is an unusual and never before happened thing, at least in my long years in broadcasting, that you know, basically the president gives you license. If he said it, you can say it too.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see the number of comment. You know, I follow mostly news on Twitter, and you know, got to see a lot of people not critiquing the president for saying it, but critiquing news outlets for, oh, you know, gutter mouths, look at what my children have to see. And then people responding, well, wait a minute, why are we discussing this? Who said it first? And so it was a very interesting debate.
Yeah, and it was an interesting discussion in newsrooms too. And in fact, we had the opportunity to say it on the second day, and I said, no, we had our one day of fun. We're not going to continue to use the word just because everybody else said it out there.
And I think it just shows that he has an unawareness about different countries and cultures, and lacks that type of appreciation and knowledge. And beyond using the S-hole word, that even when he visited China, they were calling him a paper tiger, a person, you know, that is not knowledgeable about their culture. And China is such a big country that you should know a bit of their history. But in general, we're able to see that he just does not have that much appreciation for different countries and cultures in general.
So let me take a sidetrack here, because that is a major point that I keep coming back to, is that we keep hearing about the way that people can be led astray by stuff they see on Twitter, for example, or Facebook. If their friends are bandying something about, it's like, oh man, I can't believe this happened, and they immediately tweet or send out on Facebook their own outrage. And yet, it's on the very device that gives them access to the internet, and therefore the ability to check up on the information for themselves. I'm constantly struck by that divide where it's like you respond with your emotions first when you've got the fact-checking device in your hand.
Yeah, and it's easy to happen. I mean, even I would say that I'm someone who has a fairly skeptical mind when it comes to, oh, I see something that I agree with, I'm going to share it. I kind of try to check out first. But I got taken in by a Julian Assange parody a Twitter account the other day that I retweeted because I saw a major journalist retweet it, and I thought, oh, okay, well, this is safe. And then I realized a friend of mine was like, no, that's a parody account. I'm like, ah, got caught. So yeah, you have to always be on the lookout for whether or not the information you're seeing is accurate.
Twitter in particular has a little device to let you know that this is the actual person's account.
You can be
subtle.
Whether or not you're authenticated, but Julian Assange is not authenticated on Twitter, so.
Ah, okay. That doesn't help.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to actual items in the media, and in this case, we're talking about the fiction media. This is the Black Panther movie coming out. This is a Marvel movie, a character that's been around, I think, since the 60s. If not the 70s as well, with the Avengers. I probably have some comics from back then that, and not from last week. I want to be clear on that, that have the Black Panther in them. But this movie in particular seems to have raised some hackles. What are you guys perceiving from the release of Black Panther, this Marvel movie?
I feel that it's really exciting. It references what has been written about within the past maybe like two decades, which is Afrofuturism, this idea that that Black storytelling in terms of the future can go beyond the white imagination, in which Blacks have reclaimed or are at home in the future, not feeling a sort of displacement that is seen in other films. So I felt that's kind of exciting when we look at it in that way, the Afrofuturism type of lens.
The idea of Wakanda, this highly advanced country, is pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's I'm trying to go see the film tonight. Hopefully, I'm very excited about it. I think it has a huge amount of energy. Obviously, you know, for so long, I mean, I don't know how many Marvel movies we've seen now, and the vast majority of the cast of these films are white, often with sort of a black sidekick character somewhere in there.
And so it's a Falcon for Captain
America.
Right,
exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a huge step forward that we have this film. You know, there's a joke going around the internet that the two white characters are Andy Serkis and Martin Freeman, and they're the two Tolkien white guys, because they were both in Tolkien films. But you know, I think this is huge. It's a great moment for representation. You know, the film is probably going to be an enormous box office success. There's a lot of different predictions in terms of what it might do, but I think it's going to be huge. I think it'll be interesting to see how it does internationally. I think one of the things that industry people say is the reason we don't see more black-led films is because of, it's not because we're racist, it's because other countries are racist, other markets are racist, and they won't carry our films if they're headlined by blacks. And so I think it'll be really interesting to see how that does. But yeah, it's been fascinating to see sort of some of the racist response. You know, I've seen everything from people trying to pull down the IMDb and Rotten Tomato audience scores intentionally. There's been a lot of, as Precious was just talking about, sort of scholarly academic discussion of Wakanda as a concept. And I've been noticing that there's multiple sort of white prominent authors responding to that Wakanda isn't real. Wakanda isn't real. Well, yes, we know it's not real. It is a concept. And so why are you getting so defensive about that? Like, I don't know. It's weird that how this sort of raises the hackles of some people.
Andrew Gay and Precious Yamaguchi are monthly guests for a segment we call Signals and Noise, a discussion of topics in the media. They're on the communications faculty at Southern Oregon University. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back to the point about you know, we can't make a lot of movies with lots of black actors because they don't sell well overseas. And this is actually something I've had to deal with in my own job. I mean, when picking out images, and we, you know, since we don't have a huge image library we pay for, I have to go to Wikimedia Commons and pick up stuff to be able to show pictures that illustrate what we're doing here on the program on the website. And I honestly had to have this discussion with myself in the last year to realize I don't have to put just white people up there, even though much of the audience that listens to us is white.
Definitely, yeah. We had Alexander Cox, who is the director of Repo Man, come talk to one of our classes at Southern Oregon University. And I really liked how even back when he was making Repo Man, he said that sometimes you have different characters, and in your head, people automatically go to like a white man, you know, if it's a scientist, but there's no reason why it can't be like an Asian American woman or a black man. And he said that actually when you put diversity in films, it makes it a lot more interesting. But we can't just always go to like the first image that we think of. So I thought that was good that he was even thinking about that during like the 80s.
Yeah, and this has been a discussion a lot lately. I mean, we have the latest Star Wars films have been much more racially diverse and also more really, more
yeah.
women.
Yeah.
And of course, the reaction was some man went out there and cut a 40-minute version of The Last Jedi in which they took out all of the women. And this was a thing that was going around the internet. I'm like, really? Well, how desperate and sad are you that you feel the need to diminish women's roles so much that you've recut the movie into this 40-minute version? But you know what is interesting to me, though, what sort of sets Black Panther apart from what Star Wars has been doing? Someone did a study on Twitter again. Sorry, that they went and counted all the writers and directors who have been in charge of Star Wars, and 94%. 90% of them are white men. I think the only exception was Lee Brackett, who was a white woman who wrote the first draft of Empire Strikes Back. And so what's different about Black Panther, of course, is that Ryan Coogler, the writer-director, is a black man. And so we're getting the creative decision maker is getting to add his lens, his perspective. And I think, you know, the big question now for Star Wars, who just, you know, has given three new films to the white male writers of Game of Thrones, three more films to Rian Johnson, when are they going to start giving women directors and black directors and other people of color their chance to, you know, for a series that's supposedly about people who are oppressed, when are some of the sort of oppressed peoples going to start to get their voice into the actual creative decision-making side?
Let me bring this down then to another topic that's on our list here, not quite contiguous, though. The idea about Oscars, and Oscars so white, I'm not hearing quite so much this year, but the nominations are out, and I wonder if you guys have had a chance to peruse those at all and make much of what the potential is there.
Oh, I focus a bit on the animation because that's what I'm excited about. I was happy to see that The Breadwinner was on there, and that one I think it's produced also by Angelina Jolie, though, but that kind of brings in diverse stories. And let me see, what else for Oscars?
It was definitely a more diverse. I mean, this is actually one of the first years. I have two young kids, so I rarely get out to movies in the past. And this is one of the first years I've seen almost all the major nominated films. not all of them. There's still a couple I haven't. But a big changer for me was the Movie Pass and getting to go to movies on Movie Pass. But yeah, it was definitely a much more diverse range of films that got nominated this year. So I think a lot of people are happy that we're seeing some change. But you know, still could be more could be done.
Oscar broadcast had been in February for a couple of years. I think it got shoved into March by the Olympics. Yeah. That's what's been going on. And we can talk about the Olympics perhaps as a topic too. Andrew Gay and Precious Yamaguchi here from the communications staff at Southern Oregon University for this month's edition of Signals and Noise. Let's talk about really old media painting, because the Obama portraits.
Media.
Now, these are not the official White House portraits. These are the ones for the National Portrait Gallery. Mm-hmm. Am I correct about that?
The Smithsonian.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so they're different looking.
Yeah, I think that, well, my background is in studio art, so I was very excited when I saw these portraits. And I feel that the portraits are a representation of who the Obamas are. They are fashionable, modern, intellectual, and aware people that took a lot of time and consideration in choosing their artists. And also, I know that people, there was comments on like, Michelle Obama's portrait is too fashionable, but that's who she is. I mean, she's... The whole time that she's been the first lady, she's been very conscientious of what she wears. And also at the events that she attends, she wears things that are appropriate. The designers are of the culture that she's attending an event. So I felt that it was a pretty good representation of who they are, not trying to be outlandish or rebellious or anything, but that's who they are.
It seems like you can't have the last name Obama and put your feet in your slippers in the morning without creating some controversy. So of course, and particularly on Fox News. And so there was a brief period. I'm not sure if it was mentioned on the air as well, but certainly on the website of Fox News, Sean Hannity going on about some strange thing. He purported to see sperm on the president's forehead.
Yeah,
in the portrait.
He had put it on. I know on the Sean Hannity website and pushing it all over his own Twitter feed and I think on his radio show. I'm not sure if he actually made it to the Sean Hannity show in the evening or not. But his wild conspiracies about how there are sexual innuendos in the Obama paintings, and you know, I even like looked really closely at this area that he circled, and I'm like, what are you talking about? But I think these portraits are exciting. You know, Wiley and Sherrill, the two artists, are I believe the first black artists to do a presidential or first lady portraits, and you know they are shocking. I mean, you look at them and they're not what you expect. Given, you know, you compare them to the last few presidential portraits, you know, you're not going to remember those portraits.
There's no neutral backdrop for either. In Obama's case, he's in front of all this. It looks like he's in front of an ivy-covered wall or something.
Yeah.
In the ivy-covered
wall. And there are flowers. I can't remember what they are, but there's like one.
Jasmine,
one from his home state, one from Chicago, and one from Kenya.
And Hawaii.
So, you know, I think it was really meaningful, and I think it was just another way that sort of this is going to be historic, and these paintings will be remembered. And there were some funny memes and stuff on on Twitter that, you know, people were doing, like the Homer Simpson meme where, you know, him, where he retracts into the bush with the Obama thing. But, you know, they're going to be talked about and they're going to be long remembered. And, you know, again, I just re-looked at all these old portraits and I can't remember at all what the last few presidents' portraits looked like. But that one's going to be emblematic and stay in your head.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And it turns out that when people are looking for bumpy things on the president's forehead, he's got a fairly prominent vein there, the ex-president's forehead.
Yeah. It's not a sperm, folks.
I saw close-up pictures the last couple of days that figured that's what it is. Let's move on from portraits to media ownership, because the LA Times changing hands recently, and right here in our own backyard, the Register Guard changing hands. That, in particular, an interesting story from my perspective, because the same company that sold the Mail Tribune in Medford to local owners then turned around and bought from local owners the Register Guard in Eugene. And I know people in the Register Guard newsroom are concerned. They think they're going to be getting layoff notices and all that from Gatehouse Media. I know other people have worked for Gatehouse Media, too, including my brother, who have some thoughts about their ability to squeeze the most out of a penny.
Yeah, you know, I think there's always a lot of trepidation when media changes hands. I know it did seem that most of the LA Times folks were actually pretty hopeful. Patrick Soon-Shiong, am I saying that right? He sent out a letter to all the newsrooms of the papers that he now controls. Here's part of the statement that he wrote. I want to assure you, everyone from the press room to the newsroom, that I will work to ensure that you have the tools and resources to produce the high-quality journalism that our readers need and rely upon. And I saw a lot of people saying, thank God he didn't say content. Uh-huh. You know, his thing was very focused on journalism. And he also told a really interesting immigration story. I mean, he talked about how he grew up in apartheid South Africa, and yet, you know, has Asian descent, and it's just really kind of interesting story himself. And I think he was sort of couching it as this, you know, we have the job of telling these important stories in our community, and so people seem to be somewhat soothed by him.
Yeah, I'm from Los Angeles, and I've always loved the Los Angeles Times, so I feel hopeful because I feel that so much of Los Angeles is made up by these different immigrant stories, some of them very successful, like Patrick Soon-Shiong's, and so I feel that might be representative of that. I think in 2007, David Geffen, he was thinking about purchasing the Los Angeles Times, but I'm happy that we do have people of color that can tell their stories and might be a little bit closer to the larger population of Los Angeles. And he's worked in all these different areas and attended UCLA. And
I'm curious about, though, the trend now about purchasing large newspapers, Washington Post before the LA Times by rich Bezos. People who don't necessarily, yeah, the owner of Amazon the founder of Amazon was the one who bought the Washington Post, which leads to President Trump calling it the Amazon Washington Post upon occasion. But the idea being that they're not necessarily looking to turn a profit, which is kind of a whew for the, you know, people in Israel.
Yeah, it's like journalists today, your best hope is to find a benevolent billionaire, right? And it's kind of like, you know, a great film recently, Spielberg's Post. Again, this, you know, the heroism of the rich person who hopefully lets us do journalism, right? I would love to find a better model than this. I would love to find a way that we can have independent journalism so that we didn't rely on benevolent billionaires, but that's what we got right now, apparently. So, yeah.
Well, and I should, you know, this should come up for discussion too, as long as we're talking about funding for newsrooms, that because it's on the list here, the proposed funding cuts for PBS and NPR. The Trump proposed budget talks about zeroing out the corporation for public broadcasting once again. Mm-hmm. However, that budget landed right after Congress passed a 2-year budget framework that indicated, no, we're going to keep funding the corporation for public broadcasting. So I think for the moment, knock wood, that chunk of our budget is okay, but it's a concern all the time. Let me give you guys enough time to talk about your pick threes in Signals and Noise for this month. The three things in the media that you are looking at, following, enjoying, whatever. Precious?
Yeah, we talked about Black Panther. The soundtrack is amazing. So even if you don't see the film, at least listen to the soundtrack. It's incredible.
Who's some of the musicians?
Kendrick Lamar.
Oh, sure.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
So that's really exciting. Also, I would say this book called Relish by Lucy Kinsley, I think is her name, and it's like a foodie comic book. It's it's really, really fun. And then also I just got caught up on some other reading, The Girls by Emma Klein, which is a book that you could just plow through in like 3 days.
And what's that about?
That's about a woman who falls into a cult, and there's like little references of California, and they go up to Humboldt. So it just kind of shows how a person could fall into this type of cult following, which is makes it a really fascinating read.
The Girls by Emma Klein?
Yes.
Okay. Andrew, what's on your
My three? First one is one I've mentioned in the past, a show called One Day at a Time on Netflix. I chose the first season previously, and the second season is out. Again, it's a three-camera family sitcom about a Cuban-American family. They tackle issues, everything from mental illness to immigration stories to gender pronouns with humor and heart, and so I think that should be checked out. Another show that's been on the air for 2 years I just got caught up to is The Good Place NBC, which I had never watched, and probably one of the smartest sitcoms I've ever seen. Every episode is kind of like a Ethics for Dummies, and I'm really enjoying that.
The Good Place, referring to heaven, and there are quite a few twists in that one.
Yeah, it's really smart, fun, kind of science fiction-y type afterlife sitcom. And then for my third one is kind of offbeat. It's a podcast called Good Christian Fun, and it's hosted by two hosts identify as evangelical Christians. It's all about evangelical Christian pop culture. I don't identify as an evangelical Christian, but I grew up in that culture, and so they cover everything from like Christian rap to VeggieTales to the latest Cameron Left Behind movie or something like that. And it's a really fascinating and very funny podcast.
All right, great pick threes. And let me add to the pile something I discovered this week through an article in the New Yorker, twitch.tv. This is how old I feel. I did not realize there was a whole website where you can go and watch people play video games.
I have a channel on there.
Do you
I haven't
really?
Put any new things, but I use it.
What's your handle?
I think it's Precious PhD. It's right. A nerd one.
Perfect. Always good to have you guys here. Andrew Gay, Precious Yamaguchi from the Communications Faculty at Southern Oregon University. Thanks for another great edition of Signals and Noise.
Thank you.
Thank you.